Hello and a warm welcome to the Mission Junior podcast. I'm your host for the show, and as always, I have yet another interesting story coming up on the feature segment of the podcast. Before we head to that, just want to remind you that Mission Junior is active across the social media channels, sharing stories related to the transition to the zero carbon economy. Mission Junior is just not about podcasts, so please take time to follow Mission Junior on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The handle is @MissionJunior. This week's guest is a passionate entrepreneur who runs the company EcoForge. Sagar Gubbi has an interesting story and a journey to share. So without further ado, let's jump into this week's feature segment. Hello Sagar, welcome to the Mission Junior podcast.
Hi Girish, thank you for having me on the podcast. I've heard great things about you and this podcast, so it's really a great opportunity for me to be here.
Likewise, Sagar.
Thank you.
The work done by you and in the sustainability space is quite impactful, if I have to say. And you had quite a journey. So let's begin with your big vision. Why did you start EcoForge? And what's been the journey so far?
So I graduated from my undergrad engineering program from Mysore in 2003. And I moved to Bangalore for the first time to work for Bosch, the automotive supplier. The German automotive supplier in their Indian office. And during that stage, I was sent to Germany to work with the Bosch German office, where I got to work with some of the leading auto manufacturers of the world, such as the Volkswagen, Audi, Fiat, Seat, and others. But it was also more interesting for me to be in Germany around 2005, 2006. Because Germany was deploying solar at a very rapid pace at that time, particularly rooftop solar.
True.
Right. So they were among the earliest countries in the world to install a government-driven incentive program for commercial, industrial, and residential customers to deploy rooftop solar. Back when solar was still very expensive, so they acted as a loss leader and incentivized commercial, industrial, residential customers to go solar. Interestingly, I saw a lot of solar panels being deployed on the rooftops of the town that I was living in Germany, which is Hildesheim in northern Germany. And I also got to travel quite a lot across Europe, but also particularly quite a lot in Germany, either on pleasure or to sort of visit customer locations of Volkswagen, Audi, and others. And I saw quite a lot of solar panels deployed in many houses and commercial establishments and industrial establishments. So that piqued my curiosity that being a cold, temperate country, Germany is deploying so much of solar. Whereas the country I come from is a tropical country with solar, with sunlight available throughout the year. So I figured that's an interesting sector that I should be exploring further. And I've always had an element of environmental impact built into my school education and also college education. So, for example, I remember very early on in my high school, one of the science projects that I was involved in was to generate electricity from plant waste. So those are like buckets of plant waste and that kind of organic waste. And we inserted anode and cathode plates and, connected that to electricity cable and charged batteries. So that was one of my projects in high school. So it was always sort of there at the back of my mind, and this sort of just felt like the right thing to do.
Nice.
So I came back to India 2006-2007, started looking at working in the environmental sector, but also potentially not necessarily in the NGO sector, not because they are not important or anything. It's just that my skill set probably didn't meet that kind of an interest or requirements. So I was looking at sectors that also had a commercial angle to them, but at the same time with a strong environmental impact. So I tried my hand a little bit at carbon finance at that time, because everybody was working in carbon finance. So that was kind of the thing to do in the environmental space back then. This was around 2007. I also did some work with microfinance with Unitas in Bangalore, because that was also sort of a very strong social impact sector at that time. And then I figured I was doing quite a lot of work in finance without actual background in finance, academic background in finance. So I applied to business schools, got through to several schools, including the University of Oxford Side Business School in the UK.
Nice.
And what attracted me to the Oxford MBA program was that it had a very strong socioeconomic and environmental impact aspect built into the business program. The Skoll Center, which is funded by the Skoll Foundation, Jeff Skoll, who was one of the earliest founders of eBay, has a center exclusively in the business school, in the business school in Oxford, that looks at social entrepreneurship. And there's also a bunch of institutions within the university that looked at environmental change. So Oxford has had a separate institution called the Environmental Change Institute, which offers master's programs and PhDs in the environmental change and climate change space. And they've had it for, I think, close to 20 years. And there's also the Institute of... there's a James Martin Institute, which looks at climate change and environmental impact. So all of these different institutions work seamlessly with the business school in Oxford. So you could potentially take classes in any of these institutions. And professors from these institutions come to the business school to teach classes such as social finance, environmental finance, and topics like that. So that kind of fit well with my requirements. So I went to Oxford in 2008, graduated in 2009, interned with the GSMA, which is a global GSA Mobile Industry Trade Association, on their Green Power for Mobile program, which was working with mobile operators worldwide to deploy clean energy to power off-grid telecom towers in developing countries. So through that, so GSMA was based in London, so I worked with them for a while. It was a great experience working with mobile operators such as Airtel, Bharti Infratel, which is the tower company in India, subsidiary of Bharti Airtel, and then Safaricom in Kenya, MTN in Uganda, even Zantel and Vodacom in Tanzania, Smart in the Philippines. So we got to work with several of them on feasibility studies for deploying solar battery hybrid systems to power off the telecom towers. And I also got to work on what would become a community power program, or ABC mini grid as they're called today, anchor business community mini grids that use an off-grid rural telecom tower as the anchor customer for a clean energy based mini grid installation. So the tower basically provides constant 24/7 load demand to the mini grid.
Nice.
And also cross subsidizes the tariffs to the local communities and local small businesses from the mini grid electricity tariffs. So that work we did, it was all very exciting. I worked with them until 2011, but I started feeling a little restricted because there were so many things happening back home in India, especially with the National Solar Mission being initiated in 2010. And wind industry was also doing very well. So I felt a little restricted to the telecom industry, which I didn't want to. So I came back home and I started working with some project developers in India, wind and solar project developers. And also, you know, started working as a freelance consultant with the likes of Asian Development Bank and others, on clean energy projects. So in 2011, for example, my first major consulting gig with the ADB in the Philippines worked on looking at bringing energy access through mini grids in, sort of the post-conflict locations of southern Philippines in Mindanao. You know, so we looked at not just the techno-commercial aspects of it, but also the socio-economic angle of bringing mini-grid-based energy access, and also looking
interesting.
At, yeah, it was a very interesting space to be in 2011-12, while at the same time also looking at how that could be scaled up nationally, because mini-grids are a great fit for a country like Philippines because it's archipelagic. It has 7,000 islands, the country. And the national
Correct.
Grid cannot reach all 7,000 economically. So mini-grids are great. And today, you know, Philippines has a committed program on clean energy mini-grids where they provide incentives for private sector developers and local utilities to develop mini-grids across across the country. So that was my first consulting assignment, and that led to another assignment in Indonesia, very similar. Again, looking at telecom, even palm oil processing units, small mining units as anchor customers for mini-grids in many islands of Indonesia. Indonesia also has 17,000 islands, and mini-grids there are a great fit.
Nice.
Yeah, and then work with a few private sector clean energy, utility scale clean energy project developers in India and in the Philippines as well. And then I figured that, you know, there is potential to offer high quality advisory and consulting services to private sector developers as well as development agencies such as the ADB and the World Bank and IFC and others. In emerging markets.
Nice.
So that's how kind of where we come in as EcoForge Advisors. So the company was incorporated a little while earlier than that, but in its current state as an advisory and consulting services firm, we started operating in 2013. Anand Varadraj is a co-founder of mine. He had worked with the GE Co-Imagination before. So he had a clean energy and data analytics background, and we co-founded it. We've been around for about 7 years now. And in terms of numbers, we've completed about 15 capital raising transactions and 35 consulting assignments spread across 16 developing countries in Asia and Africa so far. We are a team of 6 people as of now, and looking to grow to 8 to 10 people by 2021, and potentially have offices in Southeast Asia and Africa as well in the next couple of years. So that's basically the story.
That's a wonderful journey. In fact, if I had to tell that way, it's a interesting way that you put the entire story of how you got to this position right from your work in various sectors. And then I think the world currently is pivoting, where entrepreneurs pivot from one idea to another, but even before you turned an entrepreneur, you kind of pivoted from one project to another, building on some key expertise all along the way. And it's wonderful that everything is coming to place in at EcoForge. And as you rightly said, Indonesia, Philippines, I mean, they were like, even today, I'm sure like a lot of islands there are running on diesel generators for long periods of time. So
absolutely,
these are like interesting markets.
Yeah.
And I'm sure like these are the kind of projects that you currently work at EcoForge at this point. So how does the actual project transaction happen? I mean, if I know correctly, I think you call yourself EcoForge because you're forging relationships with clean tech entrepreneurs and investors. You're bringing them together.
Yeah.
So how does the project transaction happen in this space?
No, it's an interesting question. So clean energy as an industry, of course, has been around for quite a long time. But then the industry really, especially in developing countries, the industry really grew in the last 10 years, right?
Correct.
And that has also driven what we do in terms of our work, in terms of how we have scaled up, and in terms of how we continue to scale up. So our work and our impact is closely tied to how the industry evolves and grows. But at the same time, because the industry has only scaled up in the last 10 years, and newer verticals within the environmental impact space are also sort of achieving commercial viability in recent years, such as electric mobility, circular economy, and opportunities like that. And of course, clean energy itself has several sort of sub sectors, if you may,
true,
which all require very different types of knowledge, information, and expertise. A lot of the entrepreneurs and a lot of the companies that operate in the space either come from sort of the traditional energy infrastructure sector. So they all sort of have launched or continue to launch their clean energy divisions as the industry became more and more commercially viable.
Correct.
Or you have a whole lot of entrepreneurs and companies coming in from nowhere. Basically, they are all first generation entrepreneurs or first generation entrepreneurs who are operating in completely unrelated sectors, and they just want to do something in solar because it offers commercial opportunities, and also they're attracted by the environmental impact angle of it. So because so many entrepreneurs and projects and companies have entered this sector in the last 10 years, there is a need for specialized knowledge and expertise that many of these companies require. On the other side, the investor side, so as you rightly said, quite a lot of the initial capital into the space and the data and the knowledge and the technical expertise has come from sort of the bilateral and multilateral development agencies, such as the World Bank, the IFC, the Asian Development Bank, the African Development Bank, UN agencies, and others, and also the bilateral agencies like KfW, AFD, FMO, UK development agencies, etc. So there is, and emerging markets are quite unique, So many of these development agencies have people who understand clean energy investing. Of course,
right.
Many of them have also sort of evolved to understand what it means to invest in clean energy in developing countries as well in the last decade. But quite a lot of them come from investing in a developed world context, right? Which is quite different from a developing world context. So the challenges here are quite different. The opportunities here are also quite different. And each country is different in many ways. But in many ways, so a developing country like India has quite a few similar challenges as a developing country like the Philippines or Indonesia or Kenya or South Africa or Thailand or Vietnam,
true,
for example, right? So skills that we pick up from our Indian experience are transferable in many ways to other developing countries. And it's the other way around as well. So India, for example, before it launched the reverse bidding-based auction mechanism for allocating solar and wind power capacity, India, together with their development partners such as the World Bank, IFC, and ADB, looked at feed-in tariff mechanisms that were there in Europe before 2009 for solar and wind power projects.
Correct.
And then they also looked at the VSPP and SPP feed-in tariff programs, adder feed-in tariff programs that Thailand had since 2003, and learned that while they were great in terms of providing initial incentive for solar wind power project developers at a time when solar and wind were very expensive, India realized that for a country like us, it may be too expensive. And we also latched onto the trend that solar power costs were falling quite rapidly because of increased manufacturing capacity, primarily in countries like China. So India realized that reverse bidding based auction mechanism, which was already in place for sort of the traditional conventional power sector in India, was a good model to adopt to bring down the cost of solar and wind power procurement in India. You know, so True. India was one of the earliest countries which learned from the experiences of other countries to install a very successful reverse auction based capacity, reverse auction bidding based capacity allocation modality, which eventually was replicated in many other countries. So Thailand, for example, is now switched to auctions as well. Chile, Mexico, South Africa, Bangladesh, Myanmar, more recently, just last week, Cambodia, Indonesia, you know, you name it, and they've all done solar auctions.
Yes.
Right. So, so there is a lot that countries, especially developing countries, can learn from each other in terms of the policies and regulatory mechanisms that work, in terms of incentives and the risk sharing mechanisms that need to be put in place to make private sector investors comfortable enough to invest in this space. And also at the same time, best practices in terms of project development, construction, financing, commissioning, and then, you know, post construction management of the operations and maintenance and payment mechanisms and things like that. So a lot of what we do is actually based on this. So we bring in the understanding and the expertise of best practices in different countries to other countries where that kind of expertise might be required either by private sector developers or by the investors or the development banks on the other side. You know, so that's basically what we offer as a value add to the sector. In terms of how the projects happen, so some of them happen organically. You know, for example, if we work with a project developer that has solar project developer that has operations in multiple countries. So for example, one of the companies I can think of is Gulf Energy in Thailand. So we work with the Asian Development Bank for them on their pre-IPO private placement valuation exercise in 2017. And then we also got an opportunity to work on their Vietnamese project 2019, where we structured debt, you know, for a 50 megawatt solar project developing in Vietnam. So, you know, we worked with like developers such as SunSource in India, and we've also been talking to them about assisting them on their rooftop solar projects in Thailand and Vietnam and Southeast Asia and Philippines in general, right? So this kind of happens because these developers see that we have expertise not just in India, but also in Southeast Asia or Africa. And
right.
If our first project with them goes well, they ask us to, you know, assist them in other countries as well. Similarly, you know, for a lot of investors, it kind of works in a similar way. For example, we've been working with a green asset manager based in Frankfurt named Finance in Motion since 2018. So they raise capital from various sources, including HNIs, family offices, development banks and others, and then invest it either as lines of credit, green credit lines to banks and financial institutions, or they make direct investments into private sector project developers, you know, for financing clean energy, circular economy, electric mobility, energy efficiency, sustainable agriculture, sustainable textiles, so anything green for that matter. And we started off with a small assignment for them to map out the green finance landscape and the opportunity for someone like them in Bangladesh in 2018-19. And since that went well, they asked us to do a much more detailed market scan and build a pipeline for them for C&I, commercial, industrial and residential rooftop solar sector in 11 Asian countries.
Wow.
That included 4 in South Asia, which is India, Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and 7 in Southeast Asia, which is Malaysia, Indonesia, Myanmar, Vietnam, Philippines, Cambodia, and Thailand. You know, so that we did in 2019, and then they asked us to help them with the green finance market scoping in India. towards the end of 2019. You know, so and now we are talking to them about working with several banks and financial institutions in India, Bangladesh, Vietnam, and Indonesia on sort of green credit lines, pipeline building, ESG and climate risk frameworks and things like that. So a lot of it happens organically, but at times we also sort of take part in some of the tenders that go live, either private tenders or public tenders. Though I would say we don't do that much, but we do sort of bid for certain consulting tenders that come out from both private sector and public sector entities. And if we are the best in terms of what we offer, then we get the contract and the tender and we execute it. So, you know, it's a combination of both is how we do. But at the end of the day, we are very clear that unless, in terms of the expertise we have, in terms of, you know, the experience that we bring to the table is adding value to all the actors in that particular project, I don't think we would be pushing ahead with getting a contract. So only when we see that there is value we are adding is when we actually get involved. And I think as we grow as an organization and pick up more and more of the expertise and experience, I'm seeing that we do bring quite a lot of value to all the different actors in the space.
That's again like a wonderful approach to doing business. As you rightly said, unless you bring value to the table, you don't accept proposals. And especially working in a niche sector like we are in the clean tech space, where expertise is very minimum in terms of the number of projects that have been executed or consulted or even advised. I'm sure this niche expertise kind of has to be put in the right place at the right time. And obviously, the big players, the big consulting firms try to get into these projects, but you definitely bring value to the table more than them, if I would say. That's a good approach. And the entire idea of clients coming back to you for more business, I'm sure, is just a testimony of the work that you have done and the impact that it's had. So that's pretty good, pretty solid.
Yeah, I mean, it's not always easy at times. You know, there are certain projects, for example, that we really like to do simply because, one, it excites us. And like I said, we are not a mainstream traditional commercial consulting firm, right? So we are a commercial advisory and consulting firm, but any project that we do needs to have an environmental impact angle to it, right? So, for example, a coal power project developer or a gas power project developer comes to us and says that, why don't you help us with raising capital? Then we will say no, right? Because that's not in our mandate. At the same time, if there is a project which has very strong climate impact, so for example, certain climate change adaptation projects, and there is an element of commercial viability to it, but there's also an element of you know, not so commercial viability to it, but has a strong environmental impact, then we are okay. open to working on either reduced fees or at times we do quite a lot of pro bono work before, you know, the client is actually able to pay us. So we are willing to do that as well, because like I said, we are not a very traditional, typical commercial consulting firm. We do have a very strong environmental impact at the core of what we do. So unless there's a strong environmental impact to what we do, we would not be interested in getting involved in it.
That's exactly what I like about EcoForge, is that you stick to your core values and then see if the business opportunities aligns with that and then make a decision. That's really great thing to do. Sagar, you did mention about the various challenges, opportunities in this space and offering solutions to customers from around the world. You operate in different geographies, do projects in different geographies, and most of them in developing part of the world. And in terms of sustainability, I mean, climate change also comes along. What are the type of projects that you see? Are countries in this region coming up with better projects or projects that look into the climate change angle as well? How are countries bracing up for that?
Right. No, that's a great question, Girish. You know, I think a lot of the developing countries, I mean, again, this is part of the whole climate change discussions at the UNFCCC and the post-Paris Agreement and all of that, is a lot of the developing countries tend to argue, and I think with good amount of reason, that, you know, a lot of the effects of climate change that we're seeing today were caused by anthropological activities and industrial activities in the developed world over the last century, whereas the developing world contributed much less to climate change that we see today. But many developing countries, particularly countries like India, the island countries of Philippines, Indonesia, even the small island developing states of Pacific Island, Indian Ocean Islands in the Caribbean, and of course, many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, they face significant impact of climate change, even though they didn't have as much contribution to, the cause. And that's sort of driving the whole climate change negotiations at the UN and other international bodies, which is justified to quite an extent. But then today, as we stand, given the risks of climate change are in front of us, right? And everybody is facing it, for example. So the forest wildfires that you see in California and Oregon this week is just scary.
True.
And Australia faced it earlier this year as well. The increased frequency of cyclones and typhoons affects everyone. It affects India, it affects Bangladesh, it affects Philippines, but it also affects Japan, Korea, the US, the UK, and other countries as well. So today, I think where we stand is, I think we all need to sort of face it and find solutions together. So the question really is whether you invest in mitigating the impact of climate change, which is what they call a climate change mitigation project, where you try to reduce carbon emissions, right, or greenhouse gas emissions from different sectors. Okay. Like, for example, you replace traditional coal power plants with wind solar power plants and thereby reduce the emissions that come from the power sector. Or you accept to some extent that climate change is here to stay, and we may not be able to invest enough in mitigation projects to quickly enough to sort of reverse the impact of climate change. And you invest
that's in, a hard call.
I mean, it is a hard call, but Girish, it's necessary, I think. To some extent, you need to be pragmatic, right?
True.
So you accept that to some extent, of course, not entirely. I mean, you still continue investing in mitigation projects and not slow it down. But then you also sort of find ways to help communities and countries adapt to the impacts of climate change, which is what they would call climate change adaptation projects. Developing countries require a lot more investments than developed countries to adapt to climate change, right?
Correct.
So you see quite a lot of climate resilient agriculture projects coming up, right? Where you, for example, help agricultural communities gain access to more storage facilities for water, right? Due to increased droughts, due to climate change, so you might want to build more water storage infrastructure so that they can use store the water during their rainy seasons and use them for agricultural activities during the dry season.
Okay.
Or you sort of build in innovative practices and help these communities sow more sort of food grains that do not require much water. For example, millets, that we grow in many parts of India, they do not require as much water as rice and wheat.
True.
Right. So, and India and countries like Ethiopia, which all have semi-arid terrains, are very well suited to grow millets. And millets are also healthy to many people when compared to wheat because of gluten and all those issues. So, you know, you could potentially help communities switch to growing millets rather than wheat. You know, those kind of things. And at the same time, you know, efficiency and productivity gains in the agricultural sector over the last few decades has meant that you don't need as many people working in agriculture as a percentage of a country's population as it did in 1990. And that is leading to, you know, lower income per capita for agricultural communities in many countries. And that is, of course, exacerbated by the impacts of climate change. So you could potentially help some of these communities gain skills, you know, to earn their livelihoods from non-agricultural activities, you know. So that sort of reduces their vulnerability to the impact of climate change. You know, so these are some of the adaptation activities that you see happening in many countries. And coastal communities, for example, you know, not just in countries like India with the large coastline, but also in small island countries where, which are, you know, significantly affected by the impact of climate change, you help coastal communities become less and less reliant on fishing, for example, right? Or you make the infrastructure that they have more climate ready, so that, you know, the impact of, let's say, the sea basically encroaching into the coastal land sort of reduces. You make their housing more climate resilient, or move these communities far away from the coast. So, you know, these are sort of the activities that a climate change adaptation project, for example, takes into consideration. So you see more and more of investments that is happening in the adaptation space as well from global institutions such as the Green Climate Fund and the Global Environment Fund and others, which are also like multilateral development agencies. So to answer your question, Girish, I think developing countries, they house most of the world's high-risk population that are vulnerable to climate change, and they have limited access to capital and technical expertise to either invest in mitigation projects or to adapt to climate change, effects of climate change. So they require quite a lot of capital and technical assistance to be able to sustain their economies and make sure that their population remains largely protected from the impact of climate change. And of course, COVID-19, which has now come up, has become another bigger sort of force multiplier to the challenges that already existed due to climate change in many of these countries. So we do see some middle-income countries like India, Philippines, Thailand, which are still classified as developing countries. They do have quite a bit of institutional capacity, government capacity, and private sector capacity available in country to make some of these investments. And they do have some of those technical capacity required to execute these projects. But they would still require funding and technical support from developed countries and also from development agencies, right? Because of the scale of the problem that we're looking at is just massive. At the same time, when we go down to the least developed countries, you know, what you would call a low-income country. So Asia, for example, today is largely middle-income, but we still have low-income countries such as Myanmar and Timor-Leste and a few Pacific Island countries. And a lot of the low-income countries today are in sub-Saharan Africa, where the population is still growing and the impacts of climate change is already being felt quite severely. And many of these countries do not have a sufficient tax base, tax revenue base, to finance climate change projects. They have other issues to deal with typically. And they don't have enough budget allocated for climate change, either mitigation or adaptation projects. And they tend to lack the institutional, governmental, and private sector capacity to execute these projects on their own. And many of these countries are also high risk, right? So they would require a lot more support and in terms of capital, in terms of investments, and in terms of technical capacity. And you do see quite a lot of development agencies and also, interestingly, private sector from other developing countries like India and China and Thailand getting into these low-income countries and developing and executing projects. You know, so the risk is high for sure. But then, you know, this is exactly where all of us, the development agencies, the investors, the private sector companies, the governments, advisory firms such as us, we all need to sort of work together to make sure that we do our best in the next 10 years to invest as much as possible and develop and execute as many projects as possible, both in the mitigation and the adaptation sphere, to ensure that by 2030, the world has a lot more hope than we do today to weather the adverse impact of climate change.
It's a good short summary of the entire ecosystem of how this has been shaping out. Especially impact of climate change is going to be pretty severe. And as you rightly pointed out, different nitty-gritties in, say, in a developing country as against an underdeveloped country. And climate change is going to be the biggest risk. And you nicely portrayed the various stakeholders coming together, be it the development agencies, advisors like you, and then implementing projects. But as you rightly said, COVID-19 pandemic is going to probably impact the entire process. It's going to peg us back by some time at least, but hopefully, and hope is a big thing here, hopefully again the stakeholders again get rolling again and the projects are happening, because we definitely don't want to see another pandemic in form of a climate change. And
exactly,
that'll be even more catastrophic. Sagar, now on to the other aspects. You did mention the various stakeholders you have worked with, the developmental agencies, international agencies, multilateral agencies. The entire notion about all these agencies implementing projects in developing world or the underdeveloped countries, the entire notion is that once the projects are implemented or completed during the time duration, they kind of are not monitored, and the entire process is not complete, where you just fund money, you give money to the local government, then there is someone who implements the project, but then there is no one to take care of it afterwards to see if the project is really meeting its targets. What's your experience in working in such kind of environment?
Right. Now, Girish, I think that's a really good question. And I'm acutely aware of the general perception of how different people view projects and the work conducted by international agencies and aid agencies in many countries. And I do think that there is an element of truth in it, but there is a reason why that happens, right? And I would like to explain that a little bit today. So I'm I hope I don't come across as someone who's like championing, the idea of international development agencies taking over the world. I'm not, right? I think.
Okay.
What I'm trying to say is there is a reason why these international, multilateral, and bilateral development agencies exist. And they have a very specific mandate in terms of what kind of projects they can invest in, right? So most often than not, like you rightly said in the earlier question, these development agencies, they work in high-risk environments in developing countries, right? Both middle-income and low-income countries.
True.
And when you say high-risk, it's not just the sort of risk of climate change or the risk of physical risk of traveling in these countries, but also just the general business risk and investment risk, right?
Yeah, geopolitics.
Geopolitics, and then sometimes as basic as regulatory risk, for example, the tax regime that you have today may not exist in 5 years, sort of an adverse change in the tax regime in a particular country could just throw your investments completely haywire, and it may make your investments completely unviable, you know, and you may have to write it off. And payment risks, for example. So when you're when your business in a particular country depends on revenues from either a local private sector customer or a government customer, like a utility, for example, like the DISCOMs in India, for example. So all the wind and solar power projects, utility scale projects, their only source of revenue is from the payments they receive from the DISCOMs for the electricity that they supply to their grids. But then, you know, DISCOMs in India have been, you know, their financial situation has been quite weak for several years. And that sort of amounts to what you would call counterparty risk.
Correct.
So for a private sector investor to come in and set up a project and expect to be paid millions of dollars in revenue from sort of institutions that may not have very strong financial position today, especially when your agreement with the power purchase agreement with these agencies is for 15, 20, 25 years, you know, you do see the risk, business risk of making investments to be very high, right? And today, for example, despite the relatively weak financial situation of DISCOMs, a lot of the private investors, both Indian and international, are comfortable with investing in India in terms of wind and solar power projects. But that was not the case 10 years ago.
Yes.
Right. And that was because one, the whole idea of investing and getting paid from DISCOMs for solar and wind power projects in India 10 years ago was completely untested. And, you were not sure how the government support would pan out for wind and solar power projects. Right. But now we know that both the previous UPA 2 government and the NDA government have backed solar and wind power projects quite strongly, you know. So, and then despite the challenges with the DISCOMs are owned by state governments, and there is an element of central government support through the SECI program, right? The Solar Energy Corporation of India, which is owned by the government of India. So in case there is a default by the DISCOM, these private investors know that either the state governments or the central government through SECI and NVVN, which used to be around before SECI, will step in and bridge the gap, right?
Correct.
So there is that element of confidence. There is still a risk. The risks haven't disappeared, but you know, 10 years ago, all of these risks were huge issues and huge barriers to attract private sector investments, which is when development agencies came in, right? So World Bank, IFC, Asian Development Bank were among the earliest backers and investors of private sector developers who won projects in India, solar and wind projects through the capacity auctions initiated by SECI and others. Renew Power, which is India's largest renewable energy project developer, has Asian Development Bank as its key shareholder, and also they had provided a line of credit for Renew to develop more and more projects. You know, so IFC, for example, is a shareholder and a financial backer of CleanMax Solar, which is India's largest rooftop solar developer. You know, and So these development agencies and aid agencies, they have a role to play. World Bank, for example, was actually one of the earliest backers of ICICI way back in the 1950s. So ICICI, you know, was actually set up as a joint venture between World Bank and a bunch of public sector banks in India to provide industrial credit, right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was. It was a joint venture between World Bank and public sector banks. HDFC, India's largest housing finance company today, was set up in 1977 as a joint venture between IFC, the World Bank's private sector funding arm, and a bunch of Indian investors. You know, and during its earliest years as a mortgage lending institution, because mortgage lending in India was practically absent in the 1960s and 70s. In its earliest years, HDFC received financial and technical backing from many aid agencies such as the USAID, KfW, the German Development Agency. IFC remained a shareholder on HDFC for a long time. And all of these institutions were also instrumental in supporting HDFC set up its own banking arm in the 1990s. You know, even things like telecom infrastructure in the 90s, where telecom infrastructure investments were considered to be very risky in many developing countries. IFC, World Bank, and Asian Development Bank as well, they backed a lot of mobile operators to build telecom networks. Similarly, mobile payments, you know, which is so ubiquitous today, were initiated and backed by a lot of aid agencies and development agencies such as the World Bank, IFC, African Development Bank, and UN agencies as well. UNDP, for example, has had a very strong role to play in building microfinance institutions in many developing countries. So UNDP is still today, I mean, of course, they've now, they don't sit on the board or hold shares in many microfinance institutions anymore, but they were instrumental in funding and building microfinance institutions in many countries, including India, you know, and also Nigeria and South Africa and all those countries. So whenever there's a new opportunity comes in, whether it's technological or financial, that has a socio-economic impact and can improve infrastructure, can improve social services to communities in developing countries, and where private sector investors hesitate to invest because of the risks involved, these development agencies, they come in as loss leader and take the risk and create a demonstration effect that, you know, investing in this sector, in this country, is not as risky as you think, right? And that paves the way for private sector to come in and make investments. You know, even in sectors where, you know, commercial potential is limited, for example, in urban transport, right? Metro systems, for example, worldwide, are not considered commercially viable, right? Many metro systems and urban transport systems in many countries, they run on losses perennially, right? And that's the reason why a lot of urban public transport systems are run by governments. In developed countries, the governments have enough you know, tax revenues and other revenues to be able to finance this loss for public transport, because public transport reduces congestion, reduces emissions and pollution. So there's a lot of non-financial benefits to running public transport. But the same is not the case in developing countries, right? So in that case, should developing countries wait until they have enough government tax revenues to be able to fund public transport? No, right? And that is why you see Asian Development Bank being one of the first backers of Bangalore Metro. You know, so they financed a $250 million loan to Bangalore Metro in 2010. So, you know, and also water, sanitation, healthcare in rural areas, they're not really commercially viable, attractive investments for the private sector. And that's where the development agencies come in. And because they take some of these earliest risks in terms of, you know, sectors and countries that are untested, there is a lot of chances of failure in such investments, right? So in hindsight, we might be able to say that the development agency did not do a good job, or the project didn't take off, or the project didn't stick in terms of whatever the impact that it had done. But that's because we have the benefit of looking at it from hindsight. You know, when you're initiating the project, you're starting with, yeah, you have to try out something. In terms of an implementation strategy or implementation program, and find out whether it works or not. And sometimes it doesn't work. And these development agencies are able to take that kind of a risk, which the private sector is not able to take the risk, right? So there is definitely a very strong role to play for development agencies to invest in climate change and other sort of impact sectors, and they come in as loss leaders, and they come in as the earliest investors that de-risk these sectors for the private sector to come in later. So I do think that they have a very strong role to play, and they continue to play a very important role as we progress from our current situation to hopefully achieving net zero carbon emissions by 2050. So I think development agencies are a lot more effective and impactful on the ground in terms of their investments in developing countries than they get credit for.
Wonderful. Having this conversation with you, I definitely see a lot of optimism and your enthusiasm in this space. And I'm sure anyone who's going to listen to this episode when it goes live will obviously feel the optimism in your language.
Absolutely.
And the explanation that you gave for this kind of was backed up by good examples telling like, why do we need developmental agencies and why do they have to take the risk that no one is going to take? And why do we generally critique it at a later stage because of whatever reason? That's a good set of examples that you gave. And I'm sure it's going to enlighten a lot of people who listen to this. That's wonderful, Sagar. Now, on a final note, as a company, what's next for EcoForge? And what are your plans for the next few years? And where do you see yourself in the next few years?
We're doing great as an advisory and consulting firm, and I think we'll continue to do that. But at some point, hopefully in the next 12 to 18 months, we would like to be an investor/fund manager as well.
Wonderful.
Right now, for example, we are actively considering making 3 angel investments. So one of them is for a company that makes environmentally sustainable, no plastic kind of paraphernalia that is used in the food industry. We are also looking at a company that is developing smart grid systems for remote microgrids in Africa. We are also looking at data and analytics kind of companies that are supporting electric mobility deployment in many countries. So we are looking at 3 active investments, and we hope to close them in the next 3 months. So these investments will be made from our own capital sources. These are not like huge investments, but angel early stage backing, and potentially we help them with raising funds from other sources when they get to the Series A and Series B round level. And at some point, we would like to raise our own fund to invest in both clean energy and electric mobility in developing countries. There are some active discussions going on there as well. We're talking to some of our clients and a few other fund managers to raise clean energy, electric mobility focused fund, ideally an equity fund, but given the nature of capital that these sectors require, we think it should be more of a structured finance or a blended finance type of an entity that should have the flexibility to be able to offer equity, debt, credit guarantees, first loss guarantees, and other such instruments as necessary by the different companies that operate in the space. So that's where we're headed, I think. Hopefully the next 12 to 18 months, we'll have a fund ready to invest in both low and middle income countries in South Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, Central Asia as well. What we would also like to build is platforms, so for example, MSMEs have been very badly affected globally due to the impact of COVID-19. But okay. At the same time, we do think that MSMEs have a very strong role to play in furthering both the clean energy and electric mobility industries in many developing countries. MSMEs manufacture really high quality components and products that go into the manufacturing of solar panels, electric vehicles, energy efficient equipment, and things like that. It's just that they don't, because of their scale and because of the inefficient ecosystem that they tend to operate in, they are not able to gain access to markets. They're not able to gain access to efficient capital, and they're not able to gain access to high quality technical assistance to help them grow from being small industries to middle industries, middle-sized industries to large industries. So one of the things we're working on internally right now is to build sort of a database of MSMEs that supply components and services to clean energy and mobility, electric mobility, energy efficiency sectors. And these MSMEs are basically based in developing countries. So we are working on a platform that could help these MSMEs access customers and markets, both in other developing countries, but also in developed countries. So basically figuring out what is their capacity, what kind of quality certifications they have, what kind of access to finance do they have, and what kind of support would they require to be able to grow from where they are to where they want to be. So that kind of platform work is also ongoing internally. And we are also working on a data and analytics platform that could inform the various sectors that we sort of track regularly, which is clean energy, circular economy, sustainable agriculture, sustainable textiles, and things like that. So I think you would see at least one or two of these platforms becoming live in the next 12 months or so. While at the same time, hopefully we'll have more interesting announcement to make with respect to the investment fund that we have.
That's wonderful. I'm sure your response to this question would be like music to few people's ears, especially entrepreneurs who are just starting out and in the last few months kind of lost a bit of hope because of the current situation around COVID. But your response kind of would probably revitalize them and make them more enthusiastic about the work that you're doing. And that's a good way. And that's a good positive note to kind of end the conversation on. Sagar, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for taking time to join me on this podcast and share your views, and rather I would say share your optimistic views on the space.
It's been a pleasure to me as well, Girish. So thank you so much for having me on the platform. I've heard great things about you and also the podcast, and it's really great that we were able to find this time to make this happen. Thank you so much.
So that was the feature segment from this week. The links to connect with Sagar will be in the show notes section of the episode and also on the website missionchunia.com. Feedback is always welcome. You can send them across on missionchunia@gmail.com. And if you like the show, do give a rating, write a review, or share it with friends and colleagues. It takes only about like 30 seconds to share the episode link to 3 people in your network. So please consider doing that. So with that, signing off, this is Girish Shivakumar, and as always, thank you for listening.